Welcome to a new podcast from Granta, the magazine of new writing. I'm Josie Mitchell, Granta's online editor.
And I'm Leo Robson, a writer and critic. We'll be speaking to Granta contributors, past and present, about their work.
What they are reading, writing and enjoying.
To interrogate patterns emerging in literary culture and across the internet.
Our guest today is the novelist and critic Lauren Euler, whose essay, Last Week in Marienbad, appeared in our autumn issue.
Euler was born and raised in West Virginia, and she attended Yale University. And she emerged as a critic about 10 years ago with a piece about Roxane Gay's Bad Feminist, which a lot of people read. And since then, she's had other, what she calls semi-viral, critical pieces about Gia Tolentino in the London Review of Books and Sally Rooney in Book Forum. In 2021, she wrote a novel, Fake Accounts. Since then, she's written some classic pieces, one about Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop Cruise, another about W.G. Sebald and Germany. And now she's got this book of essays, all published for the first time, No Judgment on Being Critical, which has just come out from Virago. And it has essays on autofiction, anxiety, and why she lives in Berlin, which is one of the main things we're going to discuss with her today.
So Fake Accounts is about a woman who moves to Berlin after the death of her boyfriend. She's not that sad about the death of her boyfriend because she's recently found out that he's an online troll with a series of fake accounts. But she still decides to leave the country and she goes to Berlin and then gets to know the expat culture with all of its strangeness in that city. And it has that witty, skeptical, slightly amoral voice that I associate with her writing, both in the fiction and in the nonfiction. Is amoral the word?
Well, it's very fluent, skeptical, slightly hard-edged, but also, to quote a word that she has issues with or whose use she has issues with, vulnerable, I think, as well, without being boringly modish or too overtly up to the minute. She's just a brilliant kind of guide and explainer. And one of the things I loved about many things she's written is you're being let into the secret world, except that it's a world that like billions of people are part of. I just guess I'm maybe not part of it. And so she's almost like an anthropologist of everywhere sort of thing, of like living online, but then also like various metropolises.
I think one of her talents is finding a language for what it's like to use these tools like laptops and phones and things like that. I like the word anthropologist. I think it's quite accurate. It's hard to like repeatedly come up with novel ways to talk about technology as it changes. So she does that very well.
Yeah, it's built out of sort of episodes and riffs and sort of ruminative self-reflection, digression and so on. And yeah, it's brilliantly sustained, I think.
I definitely think that my first impression with Lauren Euler's work was the criticism, because I think I knew of her as someone who would write these book reviews before the novel came out. And it was interesting actually to read somebody who had been so negative about so many novels, in many ways, very fair criticism in a way that made me want to read her book reviews, to then see her write a novel herself.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of agree with that. I disagree with it to one degree, which is that as someone who has, I have written quite a lot of book reviews over the years, one of the things that's quite striking about Lauren Euler's career is a reminder that may come as news to virtually everyone else working in the discipline that you can make a mark with not that many pieces. So you say she'd written about a lot of novels over the years, but actually it probably wasn't that many. It's just they were so striking and the books were quite big. Like she has a very thoughtful piece about normal people. So that would be about 5 years ago now, but more probably in Book Forum. She wrote about Gia Tolentino, that was 4 years ago. You know, they were big targets, and she's obviously writing about not only the book, but the already gathering reputation about a book, which makes her very oppositional and, as she often is, meta-discursive talking about the way people are talking about things, which I think is always a pretty profitable way in, provided that you do get in, as she certainly does. I suppose Euler is most celebrated for her voice or her style. How would you characterise that?
It's quite prickly. It's quite irreverent. I think it's a voice that you trust can tell a really good story. And yeah, I think there's a way that people might read the voice as being a bit harsh or causelessly cruel, but there is a much softer, more melancholy quality that I think comes through when you listen closely that I think makes the voice much more interesting and meaningful. She has multiple strings to her bow and is juggling different authorial identities, the identity of the critic, the identity of maybe the travel writer, and also the novelist. And, you know, we'll have a conversation later with her about what those authorial personas mean and what level of intent she's bringing to each one and whether there are different commitments involved in each one. We started off by asking her to read a passage from her essay in the autumn issue of the magazine about her visit to Marienbad in the Czech Republic.
Last week at Marienbad. We went because we thought it would be funny. We came to realize the movie isn't even really set there. It takes place, if not in the mind, then in a composite setting of several 19th century Central European spa towns, in a sense of vague possibility and in danger of being lost. The misunderstanding was Tom's fault. He had seen the movie once before, a long time ago. I had not, but I knew I would have to eventually, because it's one of those movies you have to see. It's a trip, he told me. Our relationship had recently undergone a series of unlikely transformations, and it was vital to the development of its narrative that we go on a trip. A trip would confirm that we were in a relationship, and that this relationship was not going to remain forever stuck in the past in a phase of remembering and fighting over what we remembered, over things that had happened, seriously, the previous year. According to the couple clichés, a trip is a new memory you make together. It's also a test. How moody one of you might become at a setback, how neurotic the other might be about the schedule, how fundamentally incompatible you are suddenly revealed, in an unfamiliar setting, to be. Kafka knew this. When he and his on-again, off-again fiancée Felice Bauer met at Marienbad for 10 days in July 1916, they fought the entire time. Unable to overcome the ceaseless rain and, quote, the hardships of living together, forced upon us by strangeness, pity, lust, cowardice, vanity, and only deep down, perhaps, a thin little stream worthy of the name love, impossible to seek out, flashing once in the moment of a moment. Neither I nor Tom is anything like Kafka. I would prefer to stay in bed all the time, but I don't have tuberculosis or any serious physical ailment, just melancholy and probably a few minor vitamin deficiencies. Tom thinks this is cute and integral to my artistic process. The problem we had was that we both had a lot of work, meaning I would want, or need, to lie down even more than usual, and I didn't want to go on any more trips. You become one of those people who lives in Berlin and is never there, a friend said when I found myself in Italy for the fourth time in a year. I don't even like Italy. I love Berlin. You can bring golden handcuffs in your carry-on if you upgrade to EasyJet Flexi. After what I vowed would be my last distressing international vacation for at least 3 months, yet another unlikely event required me to go on a cocaine bender across Europe. That's horrible, people would say when I told the story. Truly, it was, and maybe still is. The idea to visit a fading grand Central European spa town was Tom's. I suggested Marienbad because its literary reputation for an atmosphere of romantic melancholy and attractiveness to great neurasthenic historical figures appealed. Though others, like Carlsbad or Baden-Baden, are reachable by train from Berlin, a key element of the semi-ironic Central European nostalgia tourist experience, Marienbad overpowers, significance-wise. If I'd known anything about the film, I might have thought the trip too on the nose. But it's hard to make decisions, and if there's some arbitrary theme or parameter you can set, It's easier. We would go to Marine Bad and watch the movie, which, as it turns out, is kind of about how it's hard to make decisions.
We'd like to talk to you about some of your recent writing, which deals with Germany and German subjects, which includes this essay on Marienbad from the recent Granta issue, Deutschland. I was wondering if you could start by telling us about your history with Germany. Like, when you were growing up, how did you view Germany?
I don't really know what I knew about Germany before I moved there. I ended up there the way that many people do, which is you go there and something pulls you back. So I was 20 years old and I was going on a pub crawl in Berlin and I fell in love with my pub crawl tour guide. And he was like, oh, you should move here. It's really cheap. And so when I graduated from university, that's what I did so that I wouldn't have to really have a full-time job and I could hang out and babysit in order to make rent and work on my writing. So it was never really about Germany. I knew no German when I moved there. Berlin is often called, quote, not really Germany, which is a bit simple. I always get irritated when, to make a political point, someone says, oh, New York is not real America, right? There are more Americans there than anywhere else in the world. But it's not like castles and sausages and people aren't speaking a lot of German there in comparison to the rest of Germany. So the Berlin expat is often sort of forgetting that they live in Germany, I think, sometimes, or sort of ironizing it all the time because it's kind of unbelievable.
Two of the major places where you've engaged with not just Berlin, but being an American in Berlin, or of course in your novel from 2021, Fake Accounts, and now in your new book, No Judgment, where you have a long essay that's sort of about Berlin, about living in Berlin, but almost more about people talking about Berlin, how Berlin is framed, certain sort of cliches and tropes and so on. So how does living there escape being a sort of constantly italicized experience?
Yeah, I love living in Berlin and I like a lot of the cliches about it. So I've sort of gotten over this feeling of needing to live in quotation marks and sort of ironizing my lifestyle because I'm sort of ashamed of living a cliche. You know, I like going to Berghain, the famous techno club. I like drinking beer in the middle of the day. I like that I don't need to be completely fluent in German because that's not a language I ever really wanted to learn. And part of that essay that you're talking about in the book is sort of wrestling with the idea that you actually don't need to learn German to live in parts of Germany. It's actually completely unnecessary, certainly if you're a native English speaker, but also if you speak English as a second language. There are certainly many expats from non-Anglophone nations who function completely fine in Berlin with a very basic or less knowledge of German. And this is sort of scandalous to a lot of people, particularly people who moved to Berlin and did learn German because it's a sort of a hard-won experience and they want their points. But I'm sort of interested in like what globalization and homogenization have done to what German means or what learning a language means today anyway. And I think Berlin is a very interesting place to think about that for all sorts of reasons.
I think that's really interesting. I want to know more about, is this like a defense of globalism that you're making?
No, this is the situation, right? And certainly if the world functions, right, which is not to say that it definitely functions, but if it does function, it functions more smoothly because there is a lingua franca, which is English, right? And it's difficult to navigate that or to say that directly because we as native English speakers are like the hegemon, right? And we are sort of making them have to speak English. You know, younger Germans, I think, probably don't really care. At least in my friends that I talk to certainly don't seem to care. Older Germans, it's probably very jarring and annoying to walk into a restaurant and have the barista, you know, not really understand what you're saying in your native language in your native country, and they, you know, ask you to speak English to them, right? It's traditionally understood to be very rude, right? Like, you should definitely learn the language of the country that you live in. But also, Germany, more broadly, has some let's say, self-image issues. And so it's not like stereotypical France. I think I say it in my book. They don't have national pride. You're not going to get harassed for not speaking German in a major city, even if you live there for many years.
You recently took another trip for an essay. This one was about W.G. Sebald, the celebrated writer who was born in 1944 and died in 2001. And he was German, academic and essayist, who latterly became a very celebrated writer of these so-called semi-essayistic fictions when he was living in Norwich. Improbably enough, and some of the books are kind of about East Anglia, but they're often about German memory as well. And as you said, or sort of complained in your essay, they've had an outsized influence on recent writing in English, perhaps in other languages, but we're very aware of his impact on Rachel Cusk and Ben Lerner and Teju Cole and I'm sure many others. And you pointed out that his name and the word Sebaldian comes up all the time. I was wondering if you thought that there was something about Sebald's Germanness or Germany and its wrestle with historical memory that was really inspiring people, or whether it was his slightly strange half novel, half essay, half reverie, that's one and a half, but a third of each, that people were sort of getting off on.
Well, I think it's his moony, annoying style that people like and want to emulate, because it seems like not quite intellectual, but it has this sort of gravitas about it. And also the structure of the books, what is it? Essayistic semi-fictions, is he's sort of often walking around, right? And sort of observing things and then having these sort of pre-Wikipedia, Wikipedia-esque, like rabbit hole-like type of reflections on various phenomena around him and linking them all together in quite exciting ways. I'm not totally against Sebald, or I come around to him by the end of the essay, spoiler alert. So I think there's that. I think English-speaking people who read literature in translation like to have like a seriousness, an intellectual seriousness, a weightiness in what they're reading. So I find a lot of the authors that become popular in the US and the UK in translation tend to have this, Elena Ferrante being an exception, I think. And the other thing is that this is just my conspiracy theory or whatever, but I think that the authors in translation that tend to become popular in the US and UK are ones who represent or write about their country, right? So Sebald is often writing about historical memory in Germany, writing about the Holocaust. He hates Germany, right? This sort of German who hates Germany and sort of like very viciously like describes its horrors in sort of evocative and serious ways is going to become very popular in the 90s, right? Because Germany needs to atone for its past always.
Are there other German language writers who have been translated? Because presumably you're not reading in German. Who you think?
Why would you say that? Why are you making assumptions about me, my life? I only read in German.
Yeah. Who you think, whose reputations have been hampered for not fulfilling internationalist cliches about what German literature should do or be or look like?
I did a piece on Jenny Erpenbeck, whose work I like a lot, but who also sort of isn't that popular among, let's say, like Germans on the ground, at least among the people that I know, that these German academics, German intellectuals, writers, they're not talking about Jenny Erpenbeck. But in the United States, everyone's like, Jenny Erpenbeck, Jenny Erpenbeck. I wrote this profile of her for The New Yorker. And she is another example of someone who is writing about East Germany, right? Like, so she was born and grew up in East Germany, in East Berlin. And all of her books are about that, right?
Are you interested in that sort of national project? I get the sense no.
What do you mean as a national project?
I don't get the sense that you're writing about America, for example, or necessarily about Berlin, even in Zenit. Is that a topic that interests you?
I think it sort of ends up being, I think I always try to contextualize myself, right? So I always out myself as an American. I'm always, if I'm talking about Berlin, I'm always saying, you know, making a joke about how nobody knows how good my German is, including me, right? I'm always sort of making it clear who is talking to you, right? So that you understand I'm not like an expert on the region. Like, I'm doing sort of cultural criticism about the place from my perspective, which I think is a legitimate project. It's just like certainly not the only project, right? Actually, I feel like maybe I do talk about being American a lot. I don't dwell on it. right? I'm thinking also of the Goop cruise thing that I wrote for Harper's, where I took this cruise in the Mediterranean, and the gigantic, horrible Royal Caribbean cruise ship, this sort of humongous representation of the American way of travel, like ruining the beautiful beaches of Europe and like polluting the waters and stuff. Yeah. And I also think I have a particular style, and I also have a particular way of speaking that is a very American, and I'm just not going to like affect a different persona. But I'm from Appalachia, so I can start doing it. I can start doing an accent, but that's also not my author persona, I guess.
I'm interested in what level of intent goes into a persona construction, because I think that maybe I would say that there's a persona that marries your criticism and the voice that appears in something like Fake Accounts. There's a kind of, there's a through line, and there's probably a sense of people would come to expect a certain kind of quite wry, like an element of irony, a sense of a certain kind of skeptical eye that you'd bring to that Goop cruise. Are you building that consciously?
Well, I actually, so we can talk, go back to the grant issue. So I did the launch with the editor in chief, Tom Meaney, and we did a little reading here in London, and he kept referring to me in this essay. This is an essay. This is a travel essay that I wrote that sort of weaves in cultural criticism and criticism of the movie last year at Marienbad. And Tom, who is a friend of mine, he kept referring to my narrator. And I was like, you mean Lauren Euler? What are you talking about? And he's like, well, you know, it's a semi-fictional. I was like, what do you mean it's semi-fictional? Like, that's all true. What are you talking about?
Yeah, so you're also writing essayistic semi-fiction.
No, it's real. Yeah. I don't know. Everyone's gaslighting me about what happened. They're like, you're not really so tall. I think there is a sort of assumption on the part of the audience or the reader that you are constructing a persona. If you have a strong voice or you have a strong personality, it's sort of, everyone wants you to be tricking them, I guess, right? Like, right? Or everyone thinks you're tricking them, and they're not going to like let you have one over on them. They're going to be like, oh, that's not what you're really like. But I think more thought certainly went into constructing the narrator of Fake Accounts than goes into the narrator, who is me, of my essays, right? I think probably like that's true for a lot of writers. Like if you were just sitting there like thinking about the character, you wouldn't do it in so many words. You wouldn't sit there and think about the character you wanted to project. You would just be like, okay, I'm going on this podcast, so I want to be confident and funny. But you wouldn't like write it out. You wouldn't do a character sketch beforehand. I mean, you never know, but I'm not doing that.
I agree, but to play devil's advocate, when you're redrafting something like your Marienbad essay, maybe you are being like, oh, I should make this moment. I suppose just necessarily you're crafting an authorial persona as you write and rewrite, like this bit needs to be a bit sharper. It's not the same as inventing details. Obviously, it doesn't make it fiction. But to the question, which I was wondering often when reading your new book, is this Lauren Euler talking? And obviously the answer is yes, but I just to follow up on what Josie was asking, I do often wonder what is the difference somehow.
Well, if you're the kind of person who constructs a persona, that's also part of your character, right? There are some people who are like completely guileless and they're just like walking around open to the world and not really thinking about how they seem, and that's also part of their character, right? So if I am constantly sort of open about wanting to entertain you, right? Like a lot of what you're talking about is I'm doing lots of like little asides, little jokes, like puns, ironizing, self-deprecating, things like this. You could say, okay, that's her writing persona, right? I believe a Guardian reviewer called me bossy. But you could also just say like, if you really thought that was sort of put on, you can say, well, she's the kind of person who wants to put that kind of persona on. I guess what I'm trying to say is like, I resist too much of a distinction between one's writing persona, any persona, and one's true self, if such a thing exists. I just don't think that exists, right? You are, like, what you do, and you are, like, what you write to some extent. I believe that, at least. But, you know, it would be funny if I came into this podcast and I was like shy and inarticulate, and I sort of use all the, you know, I write the way that I write otherwise.
I suppose that dichotomy is more often found between someone's authorial persona in fiction or works of creativity or whatever than it would be between their essay writing.
But can I ask you some questions for my personal growth?
Yeah.
Which is like, why do you think that about me? Because I often find people just think that I'm joking about something.
Well, isn't it?
That I'm clearly not joking, or they think I'm lying. Like, for years I've said that I'm 6 feet tall on my Twitter profile because I would meet people and they would be shocked at how tall I was. You know, I put it there as a joke. And then I would meet people and they'd be like, oh my God, you're really 6 feet tall. I thought you were joking. I'm like, what? Like, why does anyone believe me?
Can I ask, do you have a theory about that though?
No, I don't really know. I mean, I guess people think... One of my little slogans, if I may, is part of my persona. Yeah, it's funny, but it's not a joke. And I think maybe like people get, I don't really know. Why would I lie about that? That's a just weird thing to do. I don't know.
It is making me think, though, of the moment in the essay in No Judgment, which is about autofiction. Mm-hmm. The essay runs through some of the more familiar arguments that we hear about with autofiction, the gendered aspect sometimes of women being more likely to be accused of the things that happen to them being just confessions from their lives and that sort of thing. The essay is a defense of autofiction, which is interesting and fun to contemplate because it's something everyone just has fun hating on.
Mm-hmm. It is a form that insists on the value of fictionality and the possibilities of what fiction can achieve, absent having to make truth claims, which we've been talking a lot about. And I also argue that it's become popular again in the last 15 years or so because the autofictional narrator, who is understood to have some strong link to the person whose name is on the cover, i.e. the author, the autofictional narrator has a relationship to the author that is quite similar to the way our social media personas relate to our real selves. Though, again, I reject that framing, which is to say it depends person to person, but it depends also on how much intent the person who's crafting the persona puts into it. I think the fact that anything could be true, but you don't know what is quite exciting, and that creates a sort of like titillating, gossipy kind of feeling in the reader, because they feel like they're reading like someone's real thoughts. And unfortunately, a lot of the paradigmatic, the sort of second tier works of autofiction are quite boring. And so that's another reason why it has a bad rap, right? Like, in order to create the effect of this is my real voice and this is my real life, you end up accidentally finding out that a lot of people have quite boring lives and maybe also quite boring thoughts.
You're going to list those second tier?
No, I certainly will not. I'm out of that game. You won't trick me. I may be hungover, but I'm not stupid.
I mean, one of the strange things about the autofiction, well, I've got a few things to say. One of them is that some of these novels that are most strongly associated with being autofiction, such as Ben Lerner's Leaving the Atocha Station and 1004, or Rachel Cusk's trilogy, which began with Outline a decade ago, the characters, like, they have names that aren't the names of the, well, is that right?
Yeah. Rachel is...
Yeah, so Rachel Cusk's character is called Faye, and I guess Ben Lerner leans into it a little bit more, but certainly not in Leaving the Atocha Station. So what I didn't quite understand, why is that so different from Roth writing lots of novels about a Jewish American novelist from his suburb of Newark, New Jersey, who writes autobiographical fiction and is preoccupied with his sexual relationships with women? When John Updike was on Charlie Rose once, Charlie Rose said, do you feel the same way as your character Rabbit, who was different for him in lots of external particulars, who he wrote about in these four novels? And do you agree with him about Reagan or whatever it was? And Updike said, I think you'll find that he and I are of one mind on many matters. It's like, I sort of feel like this sort of ties in with this question of, are women more often accused of just writing out their personal experiences than men? And I'm sure that is the case. But I feel like for decades now, pretty much the most prominent fiction writers, Saul Bellow would also be in that category, are very clearly and often from their point of view, overtly writing pretty close to their own experience about people of their age and class and ethnicity.
Well, I think the sort of short answer to that is Roth and Bellow and other autobiographical, semi-autobiographical novelists are often making themselves into characters, right? And I think the auto-fictional narrator is sort of refusing to do that, right? She feels real off the page, even if that's just an effect that is created by the form and the style of the text. She's not put down into a novel. But are you disagreeing that it's different? Do you identify a difference in the nature of those, the two different kinds of characters?
I do see the distinction in that these autobiographical or semi-autobiographical novels of past decades often have more of the kind of armature of a novel.
Yeah, and it's sort of like...
But I would say that would be true of Fake Accounts. I don't think Fake Accounts feels like outline. One thing I was going to say before when you asked the question about why you get described in this way is that I wonder if there's a slight sort of pincer movement of two recent-ish or at least contemporary versions of narrative that oppositional. And one of them was this idea that everything is a kind of fictional mode. So like historical narrative is a kind of fictional mode. And that was sort of associated with the late academic Hayden White and theories of history and how history is written. But then also some of the way that nonfiction was written by people like Joan Didion and Tom Wolfe, they were saying, oh, well, nonfiction is going to use all these fictional techniques. Whether that meant they're inventing details or not, we don't quite know. But it's certainly to do with rhetoric and register. So there's that. So we're sort of saying, okay, nonfiction is a literary form. It also has lots of the devices of literature. On the other hand, everything's autofiction now. So we can end up in a situation where the character in Fake Accounts or the narrator of Fake Accounts is you, and yet the narrator or the author of your totally true reported essay about going to Marienbad isn't you.
I'm maybe old school about this, but I think the narrator of the essay about going to Marienbad is me, right? All of that stuff literally happened to me. And also there's the frame of the essay is Lauren Euler sat down to write about her experience going to Marienbad, and I am, you know, always the writer. I've gone on a journey and now I'm reporting back what I saw or what happened to me. And if I can like tell a funny story, which I think makes people think that you're telling a yarn, like you're sort of lying, then it sort of seems more fictional or more literary or whatever. The thing that you said about Fake Accounts is it makes me happy because when I wrote it, I wanted it to be like a novel, right? I wanted it to feel like a real novel, the beginning, middle, and end. It's divided into these sections called beginning, middle, and end with some jokes as well. I wanted to put an autofictional narrator into a satisfying novel, right? Autofiction as a form had sort of reached a dead end when I started writing it, and it was sort of like, what's going to come afterwards? Everybody's sort of asking, you know, where do you go from here? You said, Rachel Kosk is taking it as far as you can go. Knausgaard is taking it as far as you can go. And Ben Lerner has a nice phrase in, I think, 1004, where he is describing his narrator, who I think in that book is unnamed, but in the other two books is named Adam Gordon. He sold a story to the New Yorker. He's trying to explain to his agent what he's going to do with this story that he's published in the New Yorker that he's going to expand into the book. And he says, I should have told her that I would project myself into several futures simultaneously. And I think that is often what you're doing when you're writing fiction, or at least what I was doing, right? What I was doing was I was projecting myself into like certain circumstances that then necessarily changed me into a character, right? That character is not me, though the haters would like it to be because she's super obnoxious, right? But she certainly acts on certain impulses that I might have and not act on, let's say.
Yeah, there's this strange idea that like postmodern devices are at odds with realism. So if you kind of say this is a story, this is a book, then you're breaking the fourth wall, you're taking us out of it. But obviously, if you're saying in an essay, well, I was essentially asked to go to a place, such as in your essay about going on this cruise, you begin by saying, like, they told me to do it. Some people would say, oh, that kind of brings fakery into it, or that brings a sort of layer of self-consciousness, which suddenly means it is crafted, it is more of a voice.
Why do you say that that's fictional? I would say you're adding more truth. Well, you're just saying more truthful thing. You're saying like, I'm obviously not going to go on the Goop Cruise on my own volition. Like I'm only going if someone's paying me for it. You know, and so I construct a persona there because I'm basically complaining about this sick assignment I got, right? I'm like, oh, they're going to send me on this Mediterranean cruise and I'm going to get all this free wellness stuff. And also it's a major assignment and they're paying me more than they paid David Foster Wallace. And I'm like, I really don't want to go. I hate my life. Like, I have to say that because it sets up the other element of the essay, right? The vogue for autofiction or the popularity of autofiction is also a sense like that it's not constructed, right? It feels more quote unquote authentic. And what you're saying is like, oh, you're essays, it has lots of parts and, you know, you're breaking the fourth wall, you're doing lots of, you have lots of techniques that reveal its construction. And I'm like, well, yeah, I'm an artist. Like, you know, like, look at what I can do.
I was saying it's the opposite. If you don't do that, in a way, it's much more artificial. If you sort of pretend that you're only in Vietnam.
Oh, yeah.
Because you happen to land there and you've got a pencil and pad and a telephone number for someone at Time magazine or whatever. And one of the useful things maybe about autofiction is maybe it's slightly collapsed that distinction between self-consciousness and realism, mm-hmm. which I think probably was a thing before. Mm-hmm.
Wait, what do you mean? Can you say more about that?
Well, before, if you introduce self-aware devices or self-conscious devices into a book, it's seen as against realism. Like, I don't know, any novel where the narrator pops up in the text, mm-hmm. and obviously sometimes that is a grotesque or fictional device, like when Martin Amis is a character in Money, mm-hmm. clearly he's not writing from real experience and these things didn't happen to him, so it is no closer to being real or autobiographical. Mm-hmm. It is a fantastical device. But generally, the idea is that the more self-consciousness you bring into it, the further you're taking it from like realism. But obviously that's because realism is a mystification. It's a word which we've used to actually refer to lots and lots of artificial things. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you then peep your head above the parapet, say I'm here, people would traditionally be like, oh, that's really like postmodern, that's really like mm-hmm. non-realist. I suppose what I'm doing is, maybe this is a straw man, but I'm saying that some of these older polarities, which I do think were quite prevalent in the way people talked about essay writing, feature writing and fiction, are maybe now ripe for kind of detonation.
I was listening to that and I was thinking, yeah, but what about new journalism? What about Joan Didion and Janet Malcolm, who I think you mention in the book? You mentioned her book, The Silent Woman, about the Sylvia Plath biographers, and maybe her book about the Freud archives and
The Journalist and the Murderer.
Yeah. Journalist and the Murderer. She's in all of those. Is it that new? She's in all those books, going in and complaining about the architecture of people's houses. But
does she say I? She does it with, certainly in The Journalist and the Murderer, she's in it.
It's a bit different. She's a character in a depicted narrative. She's not saying, I got a call from my editor and got in a cab.
Yeah, in psychoanalysis, she's the impossible profession, she certainly has a very funny role. I'm not saying it's new. I'm saying the people who complain about it don't understand that it's just how journalism has been made for a long time, I think. But also Janet Malcolm sometimes would affect a sort of critical voice from on high. So if she's making fun of someone's interior design choices, she's describing them in a really like evil way. She's not saying I was in the room and I hated the couch. She's saying like the couch had this and this, and you are to understand that this is very tasteless, which is, you can trick people into thinking you're not just stating your opinion by doing that, I think, a lot of the time.
She was very good at being manipulative of the author.
And of course, which she write about a lot. But also you were talking about, you know, new journalism and the sort of construction of the long sort of classics of long form journalism that were sort of revealed to have been written with certain effects that today would not pass magazine fact checking departments, right? And she's famously sued by one of her subjects because she had used what she called the monologue technique, whereby a subject is speaking in long, uninterrupted sentences and impossibly perfect grammar. And basically what they would do, she and her peers, they would just take a bunch of quotes that the subject had given them over several interviews and put them all into one. And this was the grounds on which one of her subjects sued her, right, for, I guess, libel. And there were, you know, there's this whole court case about whether this technique was like valid or not. And her defense was, you know, not everybody liked it, but of course any reasonable person would know that he wasn't literally speaking in these beautiful long sentences in perfect English and in this uninterrupted monologue, right? Anyone would know that. Of course, now no magazine would ever let you do that. They're crazy about fact-checking. I guess rightfully so, because you don't want to get sued, right? But that response, oh, of course it couldn't possibly be true, is now applied often to someone like Knausgård, who's like listing like the cornflakes he like ate when he was seven. Of course, he doesn't literally remember every bowl of cereal he ate when he was seven. But why would we think he was purporting to if he's writing a novel, right? And that's what's sort of interesting. There's like an assumption of truth when something is called fiction. Maybe that there didn't used to be. I don't know.
But is that a novelistic artifice that we accept as readers? Or is it, this is how I'm remembering it. But as I think back to that summer in 1982 or whatever, I feel like I do remember the day where Yngwie said this to me or whatever.
I think that has always been traditionally like how one understands memoir as well, right? I think memoir is sort of always, it's your memories, it's your interpretation. It's necessarily sort of subjective, right? And so why do we need to say that about something that is sort of memoiristic fiction, right? Why do we really need to like establish, like, of course he doesn't remember his cornflakes. Like, why would we have thought that in the first place? Because so many of the big serious things, the big events in those books did happen. And so why wouldn't you obscure or fictionalize your wife's mental illness, but you're fictionalizing your cornflakes that you ate when you were a child or whatever? And this is sort of interesting question, right? It's a genuine question. It's not rhetorical.
I often feel if I'm reading something and trying to determine how to judge it, I have the question, if the narrator said something unwittingly stupid, would that be a flaw or would that be a kind of artistic achievement? So if Janet Malcolm says something quite stupid, not very likely, but let's say, then you'd be like, oh, that was a mark against her essay. Whereas obviously if a fictional narrator does it, provided you think that in some sense it's intended to come across as so, then obviously you're like a big tick. In Knausgård's novel, I'm not sure whether I would quite know. Like, they felt like novels to me, really, but I feel like some people are like, he's just pouring his life onto the page. I mean, I don't know whether you find that a valid distinction, because I suppose it's what I'm talking about is whether there seems to be a recognizable distance between the author and the narrator.
Yeah, I think, or some ambiguity, right? Like, you don't know. So yeah. you don't know where the author might know where the distance is, but you don't know. I don't know. I think autofiction is a perfect term for those novels by Knausgård, because they seem like it's him writing. It's him. He's talking to you. And he does say stupid things in them, like, quite frequently. But they seem realistic, right? Like, they don't seem like Knausgård, the character, saying this stupid thing. It just seems like, oh, he's writing a lot of words, and so not all of them are good. He's writing really quickly as well. You know, I think he also, I argue in this book, like, that now there's so much sort of paratextual material to read alongside a novel that it's quite unrealistic to assume that someone is not going to go into reading your book without Googling you, right? If you have no social media or no digital footprint, that is something about you as well. That's actually remarkable and interesting.
When you're talking about this, it's making me wonder, if I'm an author and I'm publishing a book, I'm thinking about the cover of the book. I'm thinking about maybe there's a photo at the back, what the blurb's going to be. I'm a bit of a control freak, so I'd be trying to control all of that stuff. Should I also be thinking about my entire digital footprint as being some component of how people are going to experience my novel? Like, have I got to like curate that as well to have control over how the narrative itself is going to succeed?
This ties in quite nicely to the question about persona earlier. Like, can you really like craft a persona? To me, it's way too much work if you're also trying to write a book. If you're trying to actually craft a persona on the internet that sort of succeeds and sort of is exactly what you want it to be and that nobody can assail or insult or poke a hole in, you're just going to be doing that forever. But there are people who try.
Lauren, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's really good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
That was Lauren Euler, whose travel essay, Last Week at Marienbad, appeared in Granta 165 Deutschland. You can read Lauren's essay and many more by going to granta.com, where you can get a digital or print subscription to the magazine.